Okay, very good. Okay, hello everyone. My name is Rick Traer. I'm the CEO of Sport Tourism Canada. Our new name as of a couple of weeks ago. And welcome to our the eighth in a series of COVID-19 webinars that we're making available on a complimentary basis to the sport tourism industry. Today we have Heather Reed, who is the principal of Planner Protect. Many of you may have already been familiar. She has been a speaker at Sport Events Congress in the past. And will give us an in-depth look at what contract negotiations might look like in the post COVID-19 era. Just a couple of housekeeping items. First of all, a copy of the session and the PowerPoint presentation will be made available in the webinar section of our website following the session. And just ask everyone if they could to put their microphone on mute. And please feel free to use the chat function to ask any questions, and we'll try to get through as many questions as we can by the end of the session. In the event that we're not able to and we're tight for time, then we'll certainly post the responses to that section of our website. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Heather and take it away.
Great. Thank you, Rick. It is a thrill to be with all of you again. It's been a couple of years, and what a lot of change has happened. And I want to share with you today just some things that I've been observing. None of us have any crystal ball right now, but where things are truly headed in terms of negotiations. But there are certainly some things that we can start to think about, and that's what I want to do today. It's not concrete, written in stone, here's a perfect clause, because there never is, but I certainly want to bring to your awareness some of the things that I am hearing and seeing and learning. So ultimately, COVID-19 has been what we might call the ultimate risk, and certainly something that has been devastating for all of you, I know, for a lot of my colleagues that are planners. I want to express my just sadness about what's happening to the live events industry. But I also know how resilient and resourceful we are as an industry, and you are. And I look forward to the day where it's going to come back better. If you're anything like me, we love to get together with colleagues. So what I really want to do for you is to share with you, I could possibly not cover everything, but I did choose about 9 different clauses that I want to touch on. 3 of them I want to go into some depth, and then some that I want to touch on. But I'm always open for questions and quite approachable, and really welcome your questions and reach out at any point. So if I don't touch something that is of interest to you today. So I do need to remind you that I am not a lawyer. I am a planner of 26 years. And if you have a particular situation that needs to be discussed with legal counsel, I encourage you to do that. This session is just from a meeting planner's perspective and does not constitute legal advice in any stretch. But I do want to acknowledge that where my content comes from is from legal counsel, and particularly our American legal counterparts, John Foster, Joshua Grimes, Barbara Dunn, a number of lawyers who have been incredibly gracious and generous with their expertise over the last 3 months. And they continue to be that way with webinars. And I attend every single one because I want to make sure that I am bringing what is the latest information and what lawyers are seeing and talking about. I want to just set the stage for negotiations, because I think it hasn't changed. Negotiations truly are built like an engineer builds an arch style bridge. They start on both sides of the canyon or the river, or whatever it might be, and they build towards the middle, and they need to come into perfect alignment in the middle to make the bridge effective. And I really think that negotiations need to start and be approached in the same way. We both, as both parties, the event host and the venue, need to start with their needs and in place and really clear on what our needs are for both group to make this a beneficial proposition. And then work towards the middle, which is where we address our wants. And we make sure that we are in alignment, because at the end of the day, we want to be heard. We want to be respected for our piece of business. We want to be valued. We need to be protected. And ultimately, we need to be profitable for both sides. And so I just want to lay that foundation that I think that's fundamental to all negotiations. It's not about one side or the other, winning. It really needs to be a mutually beneficial contract. But it does take work to get there. So the first clause that I'd like to address with you is called the purpose of event. And this is going to seem kind of elementary, and yet it is really often overlooked as part of a contract. And I've been talking about this clause for probably the last 4 or 5 years, but it has really come to the forefront as we got into the situation of termination, or what we might more commonly call force majeure. Because in contracts, it comes down to the letter of the contract, the nuances of the words. And what we found in those early days of COVID hitting kind of Canada or North America was that if our force majeure clauses weren't crystal clear and explicit, then there was room for interpretation whether our desire or our need to terminate the contract was actually a viable option. And so I want to go through this purpose of event, because what it does is it sets the literal stage, if you will, for what your event is about. Because what you can do then with that language and with that context is leverage what your event is about, who is involved, components of it, and be able to defend your decision to postpone or cancel if you should need to. And there's other aspects of a conference contract that you can address with this purpose of event, but I think our most top of mind right now is termination. So I really want to cover these quickly. And you know your events best. I don't want to get into all sorts of examples of these, but I do want to give you the questions. So I should preface this by saying that this is not meant to be an essay. This is meant to be bullet point answers that you, as the event host, provide to your venue partner that is in some manner incorporated into the context of the contract. Now, I don't know about you, but I started when we were, working with faxed copies. Not so easy to do. Now with, Word documents and things like that, we can adapt a contract setup, and we can in some manner incorporate these questions. Now, if a venue is not willing or able to incorporate these, then make sure that in some capacity, these questions have been addressed throughout the contract in some manner, that at least you have, you need context for your event to be able to leverage your contract against that context. So what kind of an event is it? For you, it's sporting events. It actually might be conferences. It might be board meetings. It might be fundraisers for some sporting groups. So what kind of event is it? How often is this event held? Is it annual, quarterly, monthly, biannually? Is it a one-time event? Who are the typical attendees? Now, you know your audiences best. Are these athletes? Are these parents and athletes? Are these dignitaries? Are these your association members? Are these board of directors? Who are the key audiences? Not by name, but by big category audience is who is attending this particular event. And are there any critical audiences that have to be in attendance at this particular event? What are the major components of the event? So in each of your cases, you know what makes up the course of the event. Is it a one-time sit-down meeting? Are there various components? Are there tournaments? Are there educational events associated with another part of an event? So look and take apart what your event is all about and list what are the components of your event. Is there an awards ceremony that goes at the end of the event? Things like that. And I'm going to show my lack of sports involvement by not knowing all of the pieces, but you know your audience best. What are the components? This is a very critical question to address in the contract. Where do the attendees come from geographically? So you want to look at and identify, are your attendees a regional audience? Are you pulling from perhaps a provincial or a state audience? Are you pulling from a national and even international audience? A lot of the force majeure things that happened very early on were international events that had international attendees that were unable to travel while we here in Canada were virtually unaffected. But yet our international participants were not able to travel in. So we want to make sure that you've articulated in your contract, where are your audiences coming from? And that's important so that you can defend. It's not only something that happens in the vicinity of your event, but where are your attendees coming from that have to get to your event? So that's an important question. Are there any specific risks associated with your event? Are there any, obviously, if you're hosting some sporting events, that just by the nature of the sport, there may be inherent risk. Are there non-compete considerations? Are there high-risk activities involved? You need to be as forthcoming with the risks that are involved in this particular event as possible and laying them out. And that lends itself into the indemnification clause, which we're not going to touch on today, but that is an important reason for putting in the answer to this question. Are there any special details that could affect your event? So if there are certain things that have to happen and you know them, you need to articulate them. If there are things that maybe happen, maybe it's a protest for something for some reason. If there is a specific thing that you know happens that's out of the norm, I think that's the way to think about it is, it's not your everyday kind of event. If there's specific things, then absolutely reference those in the context of this introductory part of the contract that sets the stage for your event. And then two questions that are new now are, what is the critical mass that is needed to make this event viable? So you may have contracted for 600 people in your particular event, but it is not viable any longer if it goes less than 400, or it's not viable if there is a certain audience that is no longer able to participate. Mm-hmm. So you want to look at what is that cutoff point for you as the event host where it makes this event questionable or viable? And that's having that forethought about that so that you may need to leverage that when you're having discussions about terminating a contract. And then the last one is, how long does the event take to plan? And this one's interesting because what we are finding now is that we're in this period of COVID, but events that are in the fall, we don't know what it's going to look like. But as event organizers, you know that there's a certain runway of time that is needed to plan. And what does that planning, true planning window look like? Is it, 3 weeks and you've got this put together? Is it 3 months? Is it 3 years? So give your your sales rep some context as to what it looks like to plan this event, because that will help us look at the windows of time that you need to build into contracts around review dates or around force majeure windows of opportunity. So those are the questions, I believe there's 9 of them, that I would encourage you to look at, to sit down, and for each of your events, if you're moving to a venue contract, is to bring those questions, the answers to those questions, forward in your discussions. And they'll just create your mandate, it'll create your leverage, it'll create your full awareness. Because what I know for sure is that people in our industry seem to change quite a bit. And you may think that you've created that awareness with one person, but they may not be the person that actually finalizes the contract with you, or they may not be the person that then executes the contract with you, or does the wrap-up details. So I think, and I really like this practice that John Foster, an American lawyer, suggested originally, and then it's been built on with these last two questions, particularly around what we've been through with force majeure. So I hope that gives some insight into how to move forward. Then I want to look at termination. And termination may not be quite as familiar to you as the word force majeure, which has been the buzzword for the last 3 months. And I have to say, having been in this industry for 26 years, there's been more educational content around force majeure in the last 3 months than there have been in the last 26 years. but I want to say that when we use the term, there we go. My apologies. Force majeure is one aspect of a larger clause called termination. And termination is the legal premise that you can cancel a contract without liability. And without liability means that there are no damages for terminating the contract. And there's a difference between termination and cancellation. Cancellation, which we'll talk about very briefly today, is the situation where one party has breached the contract in some terms, or they voluntarily want to get out of the contract, damages are owed. But termination is the situation where damages are not owed because there have been circumstances, unanticipated or extenuating circumstances, that have made the performance of the contract what is legally called impossible. And I want to dissect this with you, because I want to give you a number of things to look at in our termination clause particularly, because this is the one clause that people have had good experiences with venues and not so good around COVID because of just the wording in our clauses. So let's uncover this. I wanted to give you some context. This is what a termination clause might look like in a venue contract. There are variations. This is one sample that's been extracted. And I don't want to get bogged down in the wording here. What I want to give you are the factors that make up a great contract clause. So I'm going to do this, because don't copy this one. Don't even take a picture of it. It is not a good example. It's not a thorough and complete example. So what I want to remind you is that in contracts, you don't always see the same terminology used. I'm using the words termination, but you may find this particular clause under the title impossibility, or the title force majeure, or acts of God, or even excuse of performance. So be on the lookout for those terms, and then this particular language that speaks to unanticipated events. So what are some of the examples of unanticipated events that may happen? Well, we know of, say, 9/11, so terrorism or the threat of terrorism. There could be war that may impact where our event is. Natural disasters like floods and hurricanes and earthquakes. Strikes, if one party is undergoing a strike. Disease, epidemics, and pandemics. Curtailment of transportation facilities. We've seen that now where people could not fly across a border. So if you had international attendees, they're not able to travel into your event. Government regulations, and I've put a dot, dot, dot there because we're going to uncover that, and civil disorder. So when I started years ago, the force majeure clauses were very generic, very brief. And then as we traveled through SARS and we traveled through 9/11, force majeure language got very, very long. It was like a laundry list from A to Z of all sorts of things. And there was a trend that was starting to go back to more generic language. But now I'm fearful that we're going to go back to this very long list that has to be very specific when we're looking at situations like pandemic, and particularly if we're worried about future health concerns. So a typical contract, I want to contrast for you what a typical contract would look like. They do say, most contracts do say either party can cancel or cancel their event or cancel the contract from the venue perspective. They can terminate the whole contract because of an extenuating circumstance. A typical contract only looks at a condition called impossible. We're going to unpack that in a minute, but they limit it to impossible. And then the only option that they provide you if you are in a situation of force majeure is that you need to terminate. There's nothing going to happen with this particular event or this particular contract. And we want to build a bit different, a little bit more robust contract clause for ourselves. So I call it the balanced contract. And I use the word balance specifically because balance means that it's fair and in good proportion. It doesn't mean that one side gets everything and the other side takes, you know, a little concessions. It means that both sides have been well protected and well represented. So just like a typical contract, a balance contract does allow both parties, our event hosts and our venues, to terminate the contract should they need to, because of extenuating circumstances or unanticipated events. So that's a good thing. That's one thing. A balanced clause considers all three legal levels of force majeure. And this is where some of our contracts have fallen short. They have been built on the legal premise of impossibility. Impossibility is an objective decision. It is black and white. There is no gray. Yes, you can, the venue is burned down. You cannot hold this event. Where this pandemic has traveled from is what's called impracticability. Then it, in the beginning, it was impracticability, and then it traveled into impossible because we couldn't have groups of more than five people. And then we're going to come back into a phase of impracticability again. Because as things lift and shift and start to open up, we're going to get back into this gray area of impracticability. And the definition of impracticability means that some external matter has made the hosting of the event or the availability of the venue more burdensome or unsafe. So I call this one the 50 shades of gray of our venue contract, because that's where we as event hosts truly need to focus. The impossible is black and white. It's very objective. But where most of us have found ourselves is in this area of gray. You know, there are limitations on what we can do. There are limitations on gathering size. There's limitations around transportation. Rules are changing. We don't have the runway to plan the event. People are fearful of coming. There's all sorts of scenarios that may impact the viability of our event, our ability to host the event, and in some cases, maybe even the availability of the facility. There have been hotels that have been used for frontline workers. There have been convention centers that have been used as hospital overflow. So there's all sorts of situations where it may be gray, and that's what's called impracticability. And then we also want to look at frustration of purpose. And this has been the one that has really come to light. Frustration of purpose is very narrowly defined. It is the act of preventing the accomplishment or fulfilling of something. And this is the one that you can leverage if you've been really crystal clear, what is the purpose of your event? Is the purpose of your event to bring in 600 international athletes to compete? Is the purpose of your event for phenomenal executive networking in your board retreat? What is the purpose? And if that purpose has become frustrated to the point where it's not feasible or viable to perform, then you need to have that out, if you will. And that's, again, where most contracts do not address either the impracticability or the frustration of purpose. And our explanation of our purpose of our event will help us fill that out and allow us to have more robust discussions if we find ourselves in that situation. Another factor around balanced contracts, there needs to be a window of time in advance of the event dates that force majeure can happen. Legally, if there is no window of time specified in the contract that, you know, 30 days out from your event, you can have a force majeure event, or 60 or 90 days out, then legally there is precedent that it has to happen on the event dates. And again, that's where some contracts have gotten into some pretty muddy waters, is because they haven't had this window of time built in that would allow an event host to say, you know what, we're 6 months out. It's looking like, you know, we've got gathering restrictions in place, you know, 60 days from now still, we can't hold this event. But legitimately, venues can say, but your contract doesn't have that window of time built in. It has to be on the event dates. So I would encourage you, again, this is looking at what is your runway for planning? What is reasonable for you to negotiate that window of time where you can say, let's have a serious look. If there's something extenuating like a pandemic, 4 months out, what is it looking like? Do we need to pull the plug? So that's a very, very important piece of a good clause. Here's some more. You need to list general and specific examples. So as I said about the laundry list that went from generic to robust to generic, and it's going to go back robust again, because what they're saying now is that we need to put in things like disease, epidemic, and pandemic. We need to spell out the possibilities. We need to say government advisories, recommendations, mandates, laws, statutes, and orders. Because we don't know upon what level who is going to claim what, who's going to mandate what in a certain situation. These are unanticipated situations, so we need to cover our bases when it comes to what authority are we going to adhere to in making a decision around terminating a contract. And we also need to reference, in our case, if it's a national event, then we might be looking at federal government, we might be looking at provincial, local. If you're dealing with international, you may be looking at foreign governments. So those are three things that should be laid out in your examples. And I will say that your language should always say, these are examples, but not limited to XYZ. Because that not limited to really does allow you for those unanticipated, we can't even imagine what they might be that might affect our event. Here are three more that should be identified in your examples. If you want to address the health and safety of your attendees, so any act or occurrence that's creating a significant risk to the health and safety of your potential attendees. One that I hadn't thought of before, which is really interesting, if you're using, for an example, a stadium or a convention center or an arena, and you've got multiple hotels, what if the building itself is standing, but the availability of hotels that you've contracted are not available for some reason? So think about overflow for frontline workers, that sort of thing. And then we're being advised to include COVID-19 or related disease. If you're looking at new contracts, we're all concerned about this second wave. They're saying that we should be including COVID-19 or related disease. You may not get all of these, but you need to know that they're there and really build your case for why they're important to you. And I go back to that bridge. These are your needs, first and foremost. I have to have these to make this a viable event for me. You also want to make sure that you have reference to deposits. A lot of groups that have been graciously afforded termination of their contracts are now in a situation where they're dealing with the deposits. Are deposits going to be fully refunded? Are they going to be carried forward to a future event? And then when are those deposits going to be refunded? I know of an example that the termination happened in March and the group was informed that their deposit would not be returned until November. So that's a long time to wait for that money. So build a time frame. Is it within 30 days of mutual agreement of termination? Another important factor. Indicate how notice is to be given and delivered. This is very simple, but really comes down to is text acceptable? Probably not. So how are we going to deliver our decision around for termination, or how is the venue going to deliver it and to whom? And then I want to make one final point about this. Remember I spoke about that termination was the only option for most contracts, that they say, if there's an extenuating circumstance, the only thing we're going to do is terminate the contract. Well, it may be in your best interest to actually host an event at a future time, but it's in a diminished capacity. So you want to build in to this idea of impracticability, which means that you're not unable to perform, but it's more burdensome, or you're not able to live up to the full expectations. And you want to build in the wording that around wherever there's financial commitment. So guest room block, meeting rooms, rentals, food and beverage expectations, wherever you may incur financial commitments, you want there to be reference to the fact that if I hold a diminished event, that I am not liable for that portion that I wasn't able to perform on because of those extenuating circumstances, okay? Now, I realize that's a rush course, but that's what makes, I know you'll get the PDF. I know that that'll help you build a robust termination clause. Then we get into a COVID-19 provision. And this is really coming kind of hot off the press. I've not seen one of these from a venue yet, which is surprising because I've looked at a number of contracts over the last few weeks, and there's nothing in these contracts yet that are addressing this. So I would encourage you as the event host to be very proactive in requesting what I'm about to show you. And again, I'll remind you, this has come from the legal counsel of the American lawyers. But what I know for sure is the risk there is the same as the risk here. So a COVID-19 provision, what could it include? And I'm saying could because we haven't seen these, but this is what the lawyers are starting to talk about for future contracts. So you want language that says that the venue has an obligation to present to the event host a list of changes to their services and or their facilities that expect to be in place at the time of the event. So you could think about, are they going to be fully staffed at the time of your event? Are the integral services and facilities that you specifically required, are they going to be available and fully functioning? Are physical distancing setups going to require more meeting space? Are receptions or open bars going to be allowed? Are pools or spas or food outlets going to be open? Are buffets not going to be let? Some people say the buffet is dead. What changes are going to be made to food service and food preparation? So this kind of a list that is the responsibility of the venue to provide you 2 to 6 months out will help you become fully prepared for what your event is going to look like on site. So I find that an intriguing one. It really speaks to the relationship. And so you don't arrive, you know, with some surprises, that you're really building, how are we going to launch this event in a suitable way. You want to have the venue identify that they're going to incorporate protocols and best practices that protect the health of their attendees and their staff. And these might come in the form of 4 different kinds of places, if you will, from where these protocols and practices might come. So it might be government standards. So if it's federal, provincial, local government standards that need to be adhered to. You may want to look at what is the venue, if they're a brand such as, say, the Hilton brand. They have issued corporate documents saying, this is what we're going to do. We're going to wipe down elevator buttons every hour. We're going to be testing staff upon their arrival to work. We're going to have heightened guest room cleaning services. We will require the health screening of attendees at certain events. It could be hand sanitizer stations. So what is the venue going to do to be prepared to protect the safety and the health of your attendees? Commercial practices. So these things might be standards that have been set by the Worldwide Cleaning Industry Association, which is ISSA, or our Canadian counterpart, CCCA, which is the Canadian Commercial Cleaning Association. They have some standards for facilities that may need to be acknowledged, and you have a discussion about those, and is the venue going to adhere to those? And then you need to be thinking about your own expectations. What are the event host requirements? What are you going to know when you know your audience best? What are you going to be requiring of the facility? Is it going to be more strenuous cleaning and sanitization? Are you going to be needing to be given the reassurance that it's only your group in that exclusive space? Are you going to be making masks mandatory and therefore you want the venue staff to be compliant with that? There's all sorts of these kind of unknowns that are starting to come out that you need to be thinking about for yourself. I do want to say, and I think it's covered in this next slide, is that cleaning and sanitization protocols and practices should meet or exceed standards of care. And this is where it's taken me a while to get my head around. We just trust that there's a duty of care with venues. They want you and your attendees to be safe when they're in your buildings. They're not out to make, you know, they're just not. They want to do their best. But we also need to, as event hosts, we need to understand what is the standard of care and what is the duty of care. So I just want to take a moment to explain those two. The duty of care is an obligation to protect meeting attendees from risks such as sickness or safety or health. And the standards of care are those services and actions that a reasonable person would take to ensure someone's not getting sick or being safe or being healthy. And one of the things that you'll often find is that cleaning and sanitization are an exclusive service in a venue. Now, I don't have time to go into exclusive versus preferred, but you don't have a choice in most venues as to who does the cleaning. So when the venue dictates who does the cleaning, they assume the liability of performing that cleaning and sanitization. But you need to be aware of what are those levels, what are those protocols, what are those practices, so that you can monitor and make sure that they are being adhered to. So you want to make sure that somewhere in this provision, you are addressing that they will meet or exceed standards of care. And then you also want a statement that says that the venue, when they are the exclusive provider of services for cleaning and sanitization, you want to make sure that they will indemnify you as the event host should any sort of situation arise that they were faulty in the cleaning and sanitization. So again, indemnify is around that indemnification clause that you will find in a contract. But you want there to be specific language in this COVID-19 provision that says, yes, we are responsible. We as the venue are responsible for the standards of care. And if you as the event host are drawn into any sort of claim around someone's health or getting sick, that you then are covered by the venue for your, like, basically are legally covered should you be sued. And finally on this one, you also want the right to terminate the contract if the venue is not able or unwilling or does not uphold the provisions or the required measurements that are in place, or it becomes too restrictive to perform. So these are just hot off the press. I actually attended a session by Joshua Grimes just the other day, and these are what people are starting to look at. So these are going to be discussions you're going to have with venues and come up and work collaboratively with them. I'm sure they're probably working on language, but you're going to, from what I'm seeing so far, we need to initiate these discussions because after all, we ultimately are responsible for our event and our attendees. And then if I haven't bored you enough, here are a few additional clauses that I think, and I'm just going to skim the surface. I just want to tweak your interest to pay attention to, I believe there are six of these, but they're not as heavy. So I want you to look at a review clause. I would like to encourage you to create an opportunity to have a conversation with the venue to assess your current realities. So is there a certain window of time? Is it 6 months out? Is it 12 months out? Where you have an opportunity to sit down and really look realistically at the commitments that are being made in this contract and have an opportunity to reassess where you have financial commitments, which is typically your room block or your venue rental or your food and beverage commitment. And you want to be able to do this review and have an open discussion, a realistic discussion, with the hopes of it being without liability. And that means without damages. And there's going to be a certain window of time where this may be palatable, because for venues, it may be better to have business on the books than nothing if you know that you can't, it's not worth taking the risk that you are, it's an all or nothing. So this really might be something that gives you the ability to move forward in some manner, but gives the venue some business. I keep hearing that it's better to have some revenue than no revenue. And then it also is respectful that if you're not going to perform to your contracted capacity, it gives them a chance to look for additional business and to supplement that. So that's one thing I would encourage you to look at is for a review clause. Rate protection. This is language that you want to have the venue insert for you, because we're hearing that we may be going into a recession. Well, our group rate that seemed reasonable when things were fully up and running and robust may not be relevant at the time of your event. So you want to make sure that you have an opportunity to protect those rates, so that you want to make sure, are they on par with other group business in the venue or with other venues in the vicinity of, because we know that, attendees are very price conscious when it comes to things like accommodation. And there's so many options now. You need them to book with you. So you want to be competitive in pricing. And you also want it to reflect that if there is a significant downturn, and that typically is like a 5% decline in the leading economic indicators, that you have an opportunity to address that So if it's not reasonable to have a $250 room rate any longer, and maybe it needs to go to $189, you know, that you have an opportunity, you've built that opportunity into your contract to renegotiate rate. This one I could spend the entire day on, but I do want to highlight, this is my simpleton chart of the perspectives of cancellation that I believe we should be looking for. Cancellation is not only about if the group wants to cancel. Cancellation clause is, if we want to cancel, that's quadrant two, right? If we want to cancel, it is saying, here are your damages, this is what you're going to owe us. But what I want you to be looking for is what I call quadrant three, which is that the venue wants to cancel the contract. And there may be cases where you are a smaller piece of business and a larger piece of business comes along, or they may want to close down for renovation. There are things that you need to protect yourself against. I can guarantee you that probably 95% of contracts come with nothing that addresses should the venue want to cancel, and they owe you damages, just like you owe them damages if you want to cancel. So beware of that. And then finally, what if the venue breaches the terms of the contract? That's what quadrant four is to me. And these might be around those cleaning and sanitization protocols. It may be that key facilities are not available. It may be that the venue is insolvent and no longer, you know, fully up to performing. So there are cases, again, where you want to protect you, your event, against situations where the venue may have breached the terms. And again, those are rarely identified in an initial draft contract. It's up to you to request and to have them put in. And then postponement clause. You want to ask for the opportunity that should you find yourself in a situation of potentially terminating the contract, that you may be able to push that event out. But you want to be able to do that under certain circumstances. You may want to carry forward all of the deposits. You may want to build in language that says there's a certain window of time in which you can execute that postponed event, and you want it to work for you. You may want to protect the reason for the initial postponement, because it may still be a factor at the second postponement if you needed to, or you needed to decide to terminate at that point. So there's a few things that you can look at for postponement and build language in. And again, that's a clause that is rarely in a contract. And then the second to last one, so you know that I'm almost wrapping up, no new fees. This is important. There is talk, and reasonably so, about perhaps finding COVID surcharges, new resort fees, new, any kind of fee. A contract is a piece of business locked in at a period of time. And you want to protect yourself from any new additional increased fees, etc., by having language that indicates that the venue has fully disclosed all relevant fees or surcharges. Now, new government ones, you can't avoid that, but certainly discretionary ones, you want to have language that says that everything has been disclosed in this contract. And finally, deposits. As I mentioned earlier, some groups are now struggling with getting their deposits back, but you want to build language around deposits that say that they will be returned, fully returned in the case of termination. And I would encourage you to look at, if you're giving sizable deposits to venues in advance of your events, would seriously recommend looking at escrow services, which protect your finances. And it's meetingescrow.com is a Canadian company that provides that service for a small fee that will protect your deposits with a venue or a supplier. So I was hoping to be 50 minutes and it looks like I am. So I wish I had a crystal ball to give to you, you know, the definitive clauses or the definitive, you know, things to think about, but this is what I'm hearing so far. And I hope it's been valuable. And I want to leave you with one final thought. And I close every presentation with this. Before a contract is signed, it's called negotiating. And after, it is called begging. And it's just so important to think about these things before you sign so that you have the opportunity to leverage that contract and build a really solid event based on a really solid contract. So thank you. And questions.
Very, very good. And thanks. Thanks very much, Heather. There are a couple of questions.
All right.
First of all, just speaking to your last slide, is the area of and the clause related to deposits, in your experience, are deposits negotiable, not only from a, I guess specifically from an amount standpoint?
Yes, everything in a contract is negotiable. So absolutely, I know my work has focused when I was, I still am actively planning, but when I was doing far more planning than I am now, I absolutely negotiated deposits because venues, have formulas for calculating deposits, but my clients had thresholds at which deposits were comfortable. And so again, you've got to negotiate where is the comfort, what serves the venue, but what also doesn't jeopardize the client in putting too much forward. One of the things that I saw, I just did a rework of a contract, and it was from a displaced COVID-related cancellation. Mm-hmm. And the deposits amount were the same. In the original contract, they were owed up to 2.5 months out. In the new contract, they actually were owed at 5 months out. So I would caution you that you can also negotiate when those deposits are owed and make it work for both parties. Again, it's contracts that come to us are not written in stone. They are the first suggestion. Again, they have to work for both parties. I am all about being balanced. I am not about manipulating or screwing over or mm-hmm. having a lopsided contract. But everything is open for discussion and potential negotiation.
Okay. Even agreements, kind of standard agreements that typically would be developed by either national or multinational brands. I'm thinking hotels here specifically. Obviously, those agreements have been vetted by, you know, legal counsel at their end. Are those also subject to negotiation?
Absolutely, Rick. Now, I know that there is perception that there are certain brands that it's my way or the highway, and that, you know, some are more flexible than others. But I truly, I think you have to be almost dog to bone mm-hmm. In some of these, and you have to lead with your needs. It's not about the wants, it's about the needs first. And if there are core elements that you have to have, you lead with those and you get that legwork, heavy lifting out of the way and address those first. Yes, absolutely. Those contracts are drafted, those lawyers are paid to protect the supplier of the contract. You have to be as savvy and as willing to negotiate to get to that middle ground. And I would highly recommend not DIYing it. I would highly recommend legal counsel because literally you need to be as savvy as the person that offered you that contract mm-hmm. Because it comes down to the nuances of the words. And it's not that salespeople or teams or brands have maliciousness. Absolutely not. It's just that that's not the purpose of the contract. The purpose is to protect the supplier of the contract. We have to get to equal ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my soapbox, Rick.
Yeah. Okay. And any indication, Heather, whether facilities or hoteliers are interested in renegotiating contracts that have been signed for future events, but those contracts signed prior to the COVID crisis?
You know, that's a great question, Rick. And I've seen a little bit of it that they're starting to happen. And yes, we have here in Canada, particularly, I have to say, and I would be very, very remiss if I didn't, our partners, our DMOs, our facilities have been absolutely amazing. There are isolated cases where it's been a challenge in the negotiating, but for the most part, if I was to do a wide swath, it'd be, we have responded with grace and team and respect. But yes, I think there is a willingness to look at those. What I will say though, is that you have to come prepared to give. So if you want to look at your contract and to renegotiate, be prepared to give in some manner. It can't just be all serving to you as the event host. There has to be, so maybe it's a less of a room block, or it's a, you know, so that they can sell, or it's to economize your space or whatever. I'm thinking off the top of my head, but you have to be willing to concede and go with that mindset that there is, you need, but you need to give, and go and approach the negotiation that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think most event organizers, without the benefit of a crystal ball, there's a big question mark as it relates to the event.
Yes.
Whether the room block is appropriate, whether the travel restrictions would be such that people would be free to travel, and on and on, a whole variety of similar type issues. So, I would think from both perspectives, it would, make sense for, at least the intention to renegotiate to ensure that both parties are protected.
Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, we both want the same thing. We want events to happen, right? Mm-hmm. We want to deliver events, and they want to host events. And so how do we make that happen? And particularly now where, they need to put business on the books. And I keep saying they, and I should have started, that was one of my most popular disclaimers, I talk us and them, because us, to me, I've only ever been on the planning of the events side. I've never held a position where I've been a supplier or a venue representative or anything like that. So us, to me, is the event side, and they, and I don't mean it in a divisive sort of way, but they has always been the facility or venue side. Truly, venues want business to be in their buildings. That's what they're there for. And we want to put business in their buildings. And so it behooves us to find that common ground. And be prepared to give and take.
So. Very good. Okay, very good. That's all the questions. There were two or three other questions, but I think you covered them, during the presentation. So thanks very much, Heather.
So thanks for the chance. Thank you.
Yeah, an enlightening session for all of our participants, I'm sure. And just a reminder that a copy of the deck and a copy of the recording actually will be available in the webinar section of our website. So please check either later today or tomorrow for that. Also, just a reminder that if you're not already following us on social media platforms, please do so. Our Twitter handle is @sporttourismca. And also follow our LinkedIn page as well. And just a reminder also of our next webinar is scheduled for Monday at 12 o'clock noon Eastern time. And that will feature Grant McDonald, who will do a lunch and learn session with our sport tourism assessment template. So make sure you register for that. So once again, thank you to Heather. Her contact information is on the screen and on the deck. And certainly everyone have a great rest of day and a great evening. Thanks for participating.
Rick.